Hey folks, it's Unsung. I'm Mark, joined again by Chris, as ever, by Chris, as always, by Chris.
You must get bored of saying that.
Nah, never.
Are you bored of listening to it?
Nah, that's when I know the podcast has really started.
Yeah. It's like, well, we're cooking
here's
now.
Chris.
Yeah.
Here's Chris. Chris has arrived.
Chris is here, as ever, as always. And we're joined by Grant.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Grant Donaldson of Money Jitchell, Civil Elegies. What else do you want to put your name to?
Either are the ones that are going currently, so the ones that folk like, I think.
The ones that haven't excommunicated you from the band.
Aye.
So
formally about Blink.
Oh yeah.
Momentarily.
A wee blip.
And what a moment. And what a blip. Yeah, so this is an episode of intros. Grant's been on the show twice before. Twice? Three times? 68. You also did a mixtape with us.
Yep.
That was a cover mixtape.
Maybe just think you've been on the show because we did Short Paris.
I send you so many voice memos, whether or not they make it through, I'm not sure.
You've got your own podcast for Grant pretty much regularly.
They make it through at the polls.
Yeah, we go to the pub.
So this is an intros episode because, you know, we kind of put the cart before the horse a bit by bringing Grant in the show multiple times without introducing him to our audience.
Okay.
So Grant is clearly a musician, but he's a music fan, and he grew up listening to fuck knows what, as we all did. Now, you might have heard one of the intros episodes or a couple of the intros episodes in the past where it's sort of, you know, warts and all expose of three records that, as youngins, what would you say, sort of steered us musically. One of the key criteria here is they're not particularly Unsung, and God knows Grant has leaned into that this week, but they're not particularly Unsung. It's really just about trying to find out which records played a deciding role in aspects of our own musical development from a young age. And to be honest, the uncooler the better. I think you had to be kind of coaxed away from picking cool guy choices, didn't you?
Well, I was trying to be clever.
Can't help yourself.
I was trying to pick.
Fucky guy makes like hipster coffee and he can't help but picking cool guy records.
Yeah, so I was trying to be clever. I wasn't trying to pick a cool one necessarily. I was trying to pick one from like each decade of my life. So it was sort of like from one from when I was under 10, one during my teens, and one in my 20s that I thought were like quite
cool
instrumental.
Phase.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I was 20 when I heard that record that you told me not to put in. And you're right. It's probably more fun picking the one that we have done anyway.
I think so.
And it was any excuse to listen to it, you know. I wouldn't just stick it on all the time. But no, I was trying to do that, but I can imagine a lot of people would want to do this and then try pick, like, I was always into interest in music or whatever, but surely a lot of the records you get into are like kind of lame. Having listened to a bunch of these in the last few days, I can
absolutely yeah, cool. Well, you've armed us with three pretty interesting discussion points. I mean, as Mark says, this is going to be a nectar for the social media gods, because we can just tag in these huge bands. Grant has picked the second biggest selling album of all time.
Is it not the first?
Second.
It was the first for a very long time.
I didn't know Refused Shape of Punk to Come was one of the biggest selling albums of all time.
No, that's third.
Well, do you want to tell us what they are?
One at a time, or what are we doing?
Just one at a time.
Rip them all off.
Yeah.
So the first one I was going to pick is Battle of Hell 2 by Meatloaf.
Out of Hell 2.
Out of Hell 2, not the first one.
It's good. Next
is Back in Black by AC/DC.
Second biggest album of all time on the Unsung podcast.
Yeah.
And then the third is The Shape of Punk to Come by Refused.
Excellent.
12 chimerical. Was it some chimerical bombinations in 12 bursts or
yes,
something?
Yes, that's right.
The full name of that. Before we go into those, can you tell us some albums that almost made it?
I do actually have a I had 8 records that I was going to pick from, and then you obviously shunned me back the first one. So
okay, let me
pull the list up. So the one the third one I was going to pick was The Chariot with Long Live.
The Chariot, I mean, to be fair, as I said, it is one that we might actually do an episode on.
I think that would be a good episode.
But, genuinely an unsung band.
Yeah, so that was the thing. I got into the Meatloaf record was when I was 7 or 8. Back in Black, I must have been 12 or 13. And then I was about 20, maybe just about to turn 21 when I got the Chariot record. Mm-hmm. So it was all kind of stuff that like set the course for all that stuff going forward. Okay,
what else?
Converge, You Feel Me.
I've already done a Converge episode, but yeah.
And the Raconteurs' first album, Broken Boy Soldiers. It was like one of the first records I bought with money. That,
is that, what's his name, Jack
White? Jack White and Brendan Benson. Mm. And I can't remember the bassist, but the drummer was Patrick Keeler. They were the rhythm section in the Greenhorns, like a kind of late 90s kind of grunge band.
But I remember it being a bit of a super group.
Yeah. Live a simple life in a quiet town. Steady as she goes. Steady as she goes.
So steady as she goes. You know, it's interesting actually, just going back to that, you said You Fail Me, and obviously, we did Converge for our fourth episode.
Second episode was Jane Doe.
Mm-hmm. So, I was going through all my notes recently, as many folders under this table will attest, and I did kind of think, should maybe I pick You Fail Me?
Because you should have picked Axe to Fall.
Axe to Fall is also another really good. It was
so Axe to Fall was the first record I heard by them, and I thought it was really good. And then I went back and I got You Feel Me, but that was the first time I realised like heavy music like that could be like the production of that and everything was just like really blew me away.
Okay,
so I was a close contender for Chariot, but I actually thought the Chariot record would probably have not been talked about in the show as much as
it hasn't.
Converge.
But it might. Raconteurs feels more like something that would come up and sound as a pound.
Well, so the reason I was going to pick that, I think that's because it was like I bought it after Paper Round or something. I was doing like covering someone, so it was the first record I bought with my own money. I remember having it on in the house or in the car or something. My folks were like, "Get that out." And it was the first time I was like, I really like this, but no one else in my house does. And it felt like it was just like mine.
Yeah.
So that's why I was going to pick that, because I don't like it that much anymore. I think it's like fine. I think it was more just like that thing of like realizing I was into weird music. Mm. You know what I mean? So that's why I was going to pick that, but it's not like super influential or like a favorite record or whatever. So that's why it didn't.
You like it because it pissed off your folks.
And even like my pals at school were not into it at all.
It's an important rite of passage.
So that way of like, but I was just so convinced that it was
correct.
Something that I should be listening to instead of people being like, I don't like it. So like, that's why I was going to pick that one. It's not a cool record either. I had it on the other day. There's a couple of bits in it. I mean, I'll get into this as well. There's some things I'm like, oh, I've played that drum part.
It's imprinted.
But I've got a bit in my notes, we can get into that. But like, yeah, I feel like, was it Rich was talking about that, about listening to old records?
We did about 14 hours of Black Sabbath, so excuse me.
But Rich was saying that, is it not like he listens to stuff he's not listened to at school, and folk are like, oh, that's lame. And he's like, why wouldn't you though?
Oh,
if you
like
records.
That's right, aye. He's so always like, been like that, yeah.
I've told people this before and they rolled their eyes and they were like, that sounds awful. Once a year, I have a playlist and streaming that is all the old records I used to listen to when I was in my teenage years.
Yeah.
And I put it on shuffle for the week and listen to nothing else but that. And it is equally funny as fuck, punishing. And also you're just like, that bit is cool, or I have lifted that subconsciously from a part.
Yeah.
It's just really interesting.
Sometimes it's good to lift a bit and put it in a different context that's not shit. So, I mean, I say that as somebody that's definitely lifted certain melodic moments from Everclear or Bush or something like that, where I'm like...
Consciously or subconsciously? Because a lot of the time I'm not listening to these records.
Subconsciously.
Yeah, subconsciously.
You're just like, that's a cool pattern or shape, but I just don't like this band or song or whatever. It's just, I just want to put it somewhere else. But yeah, no, it's an interesting little selection there. Now, before we start going through your three main choices, there's a couple of things that strike me. First of all, a wee bit of admin.
Yeah, so if you enjoy the podcast, you can join us on our Patreon, which is patreon.com/unsungpod, and there you can give us some money, which is great. Mm-hmm. The main reason we do it. No, actually, the main reason we do it is because...
No, that's the next topic we're going to talk about.
The main reason we do it is because we like to support artists who we think are genuinely unsung, and whose records we think deserve a wider audience. So the highest tier on our Patreon is our record club, which is £15 per month. And every month we'll send you a record that we've handpicked and usually bought directly from an artist, if not from a small label.
When we say record, just want to be clear, it is digital these days, and that allows us to basically reach people all around the world. We used to do it on vinyl, but unfortunately the shipping costs were sometimes 2 and 3 times the price of the actual records.
Yeah, so if that sounds like it might be something you're into, then please go to patreon.com/unsungpod. Alternatively, if you just want to buy us a beer or half a pint, then the lowest tier there is also our AAA.
Depends who you're drinking, really.
Yeah. And you get access to episodes a few days early. You get bonus episodes as and when they happen, and you get to chat to us directly in our Facebook group. So yeah, both the tiers are available depending on what you want to do with your cash to support us.
Absolutely.
Also, if you are a fan of the podcast, we urge you to share this episode or any other episode with your pals and on social media, because hey, it's fun to share cool stuff with people that you really care about. Am I right?
It's chilling from the concept of social media there, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I've sent the RDM episodes to quite a few people.
It's one of our most popular episodes of 2000.
Even guys I know who are like massive RDM fans. Because I thought I was an REM fan until I listened to that. But I've sent it to like at least 10 people.
I'm going really down as like the great REM fan, and I'm just obsessive in the detail. And talking to Cash and talking to Rick. A bit of an announcement earlier on.
That was fucking wild, wasn't it?
I was mental, yeah. I got sent, I think we all got sent at the one time, this yeah. poster that was released.
Back to the beginning,
like the Black Sabbath's last ever concert, going to be held at Villa Park in Birmingham in July of this year. The support bands, Metallica, Slayer, Mastodon,
Lamb of God,
Gojira, Lamb of God.
And then a super group comprising loads of people, like Fred Durst,
Jonathan Davis,
Wolfgang Van Halen, KK Dowling. I'm surprised Rob Halford's not on, actually.
Billy Corgan,
yeah. Rob Halford maybe will get added to it because he is from Birmingham. And one of his bandmates is on the bill, so
yeah.
Former bandmates, rather.
Well, this is an interesting thing because Rick did observe that there's no ex-members of Black Sabbath other than the actual members of Black Sabbath, but there's plenty of ex-members of Ozzy's band. Yeah, yet, but also, and I'd, you know, being optimistic, I was like, maybe they're going to get added, or maybe it'll be a surprise appearance by like Halford comes out for one, because goodness knows Ozzy is probably the shakiest peg that entire event is hanging on. But yeah, maybe Halford will come out, and you know, I can't see Dio coming out given that he's dead, but
hologram Dio.
It's interesting. They absolutely have to get Tony Martin to come out, like, because he's still playing those songs.
He's still playing, yeah. He's wrap around shades and he's shaved like tribal haircut.
Yeah, guy's got a look.
But yeah, that getting announced was pretty interesting.
Maybe your episodes made them go like, oh, fuck, we got
maybe. I think it got them out of retirement. I do. I think that spike in sales, they were like, guys, there's still life in the old dog yet.
Adam forwarded his episode to Ozzy, being like, just FYI.
I was just going to say, like when we had Aaron on the podcast, he absolutely 100% knew that was happening. There is no way he didn't know that wasn't happening.
I'm sure, I was saying before we started recording, that I'm sure Aaron told me about that.
No, he didn't.
He mentioned, they were trying to do like a last show.
No, Aaron was completely discreet. Sharon.
Maybe it was more like that bit out.
100% you just imagined it.
Oh, maybe I did.
Yeah, well done. Good backtrack. A couple of people, maybe the cynics among us, were a little bit surprised. Oh, Pantera's on there. Plenty of white wine in the rider. Mm-hmm. But then again, Zakk Wylde is in Pantera now, and Zakk Wylde and Ozzy are tight. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. That's probably the entire reason.
That's what I'd suggested to Rick. And the other thing that we thought was interesting was that Tom Morello has put his lefty credentials to one side for Pantera, because he's on a bill and he's part of that giant choir thing that includes Davey Draymond of Disturbed, who I think was signing Israeli missiles last year at some point, amongst others. Interesting.
Separate green rooms, I imagine.
Yeah, Che Guevara would be into the Live Nation.
Yeah, I don't think so.
There you go, though, eh?
That's how we'd be
Rage any Against the Machine. There'll be a wee bit of that chat later on as well, because we are talking about Refused. Speaking of which, what order are we going to tackle?
Let's do it chronologically.
I'd say chronologically. Let's try getting the mindset.
Older to younger, or younger to older?
As in when I first started listening to them.
Right, okay, so that
so I'd say Battle of Hell 2.
Battle of Hell 2 first, starting big. Now, I do want to point out that when I saw the records you picked, I was like, fucking Mark does not even need to bring any notes this week.
Oh, well, I had to do a little bit of research on AC/DC, just a tiny bit.
Tiny bit, yeah.
I had a sneaky suspicion you were a meter. Is that what they call the fans?
that's exactly what they call the fans.
As a vegan, I find that offensive.
Yeah. It's the name of the fan club as well. Mm-hmm. Meters.
My dad's a fan, so I grew up listening to him. He also had this record when
so
I was
So who is
quite
this
young.
Meatloaf character?
Well, everybody knows who the Meatloaf character is. there's no point introducing him at all, really. I suppose maybe getting context for this record is quite interesting.
Do you know that unlike Back in Black, the second biggest selling album of all time, Battle of Hell 2 was number one in the USA?
That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there you go. Shape of Punk to Come was not. Funny audience. So bearing in mind that we're talking about Battle of Hell 2 here, Jim Steinman, you probably know this, like, spoke at length about Battle of Hell 2 and about how it was a return to the characters, the Bativerse that he'd set up in Battle of Hell 1, and that he wanted to revisit those characters, see where they were in their story, see what was going on with them, explore other avenues of the characters. And he compared it, I think, to The Godfather Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Meatloaf, on the other hand, said we called it Battle of Hell 2 because that would help it sell shitloads.
I also had this note as well.
Quite on the same page.
There's no narrative thread, but there's a narrative thread and a song in the first Battle of Hell record, and like, that is it.
Yeah, was there, you know? There wasn't a narrative thread in the first album, yeah. Let alone between the two albums.
No, because the music video for I Do Anything For Love is based on Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And like, that's kind of not even suggested in the lyrics, I guess, but they self-reference some of the lyrics from the first Battle of Hell, but that, as far as I can tell, is the only connection between the two and the album titles and like some of the artwork and stuff, but there's not like a narrative or like a theme or a story really going through it all. So I agree with Meatloaf on the
Well, also, I mean, he was on a downslope in terms of like critical and commercial success. You know, I think the last record, what was it Blind Before I Stop, or was it Bad Attitude? Was his record before this one?
I don't know.
One or the other. Anyway, like, he hadn't worked with Steinman for a couple, or hadn't a Steinman song for a couple of records. Yeah, I think that went silver in the UK, which was the lowest thing he'd had charted.
See, after Battle of Hell 1, he did Dead Ringer, which was like a number one in the UK, but only got to number 45 in the States. Why is Dead Ringer not on Spotify? Is this like a Steinman Meatloaf thing?
I'm not sure, because he's also producer and songwriter on that record, Steinman, so...
I don't get it. It's not there in his discography. It seemed like a really big omission. I don't know if it's the only one. It probably isn't.
Is it under Cher? Because I think she's got a version of Dead Ringer.
No, Dead Ringer, the album.
Oh, the album. Sorry.
Yeah, it was the follow-up album, and it got to number one here, but we can't get it on Spotify.
Oh, that is
odd. I don't know where it stands in other streaming services. There are other streaming services available, folks, such as Tidal, which I believe our man Dave is a fan of these days.
Yep.
I'm a fan of Battle of Hell, the first one. I'm quite a big fan of the first Battle of Hell, 1977, that came out. There's a man in the shadows with a gun in his eye and a blade shining no so bright. There's evil in the air and there's thunder in the sky and a killer's on the bloodshot streets. On down in the tunnel with a... 16 years between that and this record. I had always assumed that if I explored Battle of Hell 2, it would be better than it is. I mean, Battle of Hell, the original one, has 2 out of 3 ain't bad. It's got Paradise with a Dashboard Light. It's got You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth. It's got Heaven Can Wait. And that's aside from, obviously, from Battle of Hell itself. There's so much quality in it. There's so many hooks in it as well. And this is just bloated and shit as an album, it feels to me that this record is totally reliant on "I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That." Because even like tracks that the sort of sub singles like "Rock and Roll Dreams Come True" and stuff. That feels to me like it might have scraped in to like an album track status on "Bat Out of Hell 1," but I just feel like the overall quality is so much lower on this record. Plus, it starts to feel really anachronistic because it's fucking 1993. Now, don't get me wrong, I get that the big single was a huge big single hit, and that Bryan Adams' sort of sense of like just this giant mega hit thing, but the album itself feels so redundant. It doesn't even really feel all that connected spiritually to the kind of almost gospely nature of "The Bat Out of Hell," the first one. You know, it felt quite celebratory, that album. And this tries to be as flamboyant. I just think it feels really flat, though. So I'm kind of curious, like, was this one of those ones? Like, for me, "Bat Out of Hell" was that my dad had about 3 cassettes in the car when he learned to drive, and I was 10 years old at that point, and so we just heard 3 cassettes over and over and over again until they were fucking burned into your head. Is that how you came to this?
Yeah, so "Bat Out of Hell 2 came out in 93, so I'd have been 1, so I didn't actually listen to it until I was like 7 or 8, so you're talking like 99. When I was younger, Meatloaf was just on in the car all the time.
It's amazing how different our lives were at that point.
So yeah, I just like, my earliest memory of being in a car, Meatloaf was on, mm-hmm. but it was "Bat Out of Hell 1. Mm-hmm. Context of this is like, I think it was about 1998 or 1999, and the TV was usually on in the evening, and if it was like MTV or something, or VH1 or whatever it was, anytime there was a music video that I really liked, my mum would shout me through. So it was like Celine Dion, Aerosmith, Belinda Carlisle and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'd always get shout down for them, and it was the "I Do Anything for Love" video, and sometimes at certain times of night it would be the full version.
The 12-minute one.
Uh-huh.
The definitive version, as they maintain.
That was how I noticed music being more than a thing of like just something that was on in the car. And then I think my mum went out and got the CD for me, and I sat down and I listened to it from start to end and read the lyric sheet and had the fold out and stuff. It wasn't like a deluxe version, but it was actually folded out. And I remember just being like, oh, this is actually something more tangible to listen to, like the artwork in the folder, the music video. And it's kind of like emo, romantic stuff, like life and death, love, shit like that.
It's not subtle.
No,
it's not meant to be.
But yeah, it's just like, it just seemed this like full package thing instead of compared to just like what was on in the radio or what was on in the car. Obviously, 90s was full of like boy bands singing in front of like private jets and shit like that. It was just this thing that really gripped me. And I just obsessed over that album for like a year. And then I went back and actually listened to "Bat Out of Hell 1 and I was like, oh, this is much better.
But I think it was more just discovery.
I think it was more just because it was this like full thing. It wasn't just a one-off hit in the radio and shit. And it was, don't get me wrong, I've gone and watched quite a few live videos of like him in 93, and they'd already dropped a key by the time they were doing the live show.
Yeah.
So my first gig I ever went and saw was Meatloaf.
Nice. Really? Wow, where was that?
SECC.
Goodness me.
So that would have been, I should have checked with my mum, I think it would have been about 2002, 2003.
My dad would have been in that show.
Yes. Yeah, I'd have been 9, maybe 10. First gig I've ever been to, so obviously it was like heavy sold out. There was loads of like, we're the youngest folk by a mile. There was no support band. They just played music videos of his new single that was out.
Wow. I was actually going to ask who supported it.
There maybe was someone, but I think we must have missed it.
Yeah.
But there was no music between or before he came on. They just were playing his music videos over and over again on the screens. And they delayed the tour because he was ill. So they wheeled him out in a hospital bed, and he like comes up like Frankenstein's monster. Mm. And then they started the show, and it was like 3 hours long. And at the end, they went off and they hadn't played "I Would Do Anything for Love." And I was like, they've not played. And obviously, I didn't know what an encore was.
Yeah.
And then they came back on. So obviously in that song, the female voice starts like kind of back quarter of it or whatever. She got descended down like a big pearl or like a big clam, and it opened up. And then she sang her verse. So there's the bit when it kind of builds up with a female voice and it cuts out, and she's like, something, you'll be screwing around. Usually live there's a pause, and he goes like, I won't do that. And it goes to the end. He just went, after a really long pause, he's like, so she said, you'll be screwing around. Long pause. And that was it. And the crowd went fucking mad. And then he finished the song, and then they all went off again, and they came out and did "Bat Out of Hell," and it was like 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
And there was like, everyone in the crowd was like crying, dancing, singing. It was just so like, everyone was there for it. And it was like, I just, all the way home in the car, I was like, I was wild. And when we got home, I was like, Mum, is that not the best thing you've ever seen? And she's like, it's the worst time I've seen them.
Wow.
They'd seen them in the 80s.
Yeah.
And she's like, it's nothing. And what he used to do, like front flips and drink a whole bottle of Jacks, and not in a healthy way, but like, you know what I mean? Like,
how can you drink a whole bottle of Jacks in a healthy way?
Because like, obviously in the 80s, they had like a lot of shows where he would like black out. Because he was like raging out, okay. But she's like, I saw him in his heyday when he could actually hold the notes and stuff. And in my head, because I was 8, I was like, that was just the fucking best thing. And I'd started playing drums by that point. So my drum teacher's like, watch the drummer. And I remember just like fixating and all that. And they had like the light show and production and shit. And I was like, it was the coolest thing. So for like the first experience of live music,
It's a big, big spectacle to be, you know, inaugurated into.
And the payoff of like listening to the records for like, I must have been listening to the records for like a good couple of years and then seeing it live.
Yeah.
So see like the anticipation of building up to actually see it live and stuff. Yeah. It was really good.
And it's, again, so many hooks in it as well. It's not like you're wading through loads of shit waiting for a single.
I think there must have been some shit.
There would have been. I mean, if he was selling a new album, there would have been some shit, but there's such a volume of stuff to draw on from the past as well. That's really interesting. Mark, I mean, you obviously have been exposed to Meatloaf from an early age.
My dad bought this when it came out, and I remember listening to it in the car, and I think I must have been about 1993, so I guess I was about six or seven, I would have been. I remember being taken by the same thing. It's like, there may not be a narrative to the record, but there's characters and there's narratives to pretty much all the songs contained in their own, and it's really dramatic and overblown. I think Wagnerian rock, I think is what they call it.
That's right, yeah.
Because it has got that, you know, shades of that kind of...
Because it drifts to the right.
Yeah. Well, he definitely did do that. Probably COVID that killed him as well.
I think that was the thing I connected with, was that some of the songs, like Objects in the Rearview Mirror, are about like his brother dying.
I know I still believe in never let me leave. I had to run away alone. So many threats and fears, so many wasted years before my life became my own.
But I don't think his brother in real life died, but he obviously had a very like troublesome upbringing.
Yeah.
And some of it just felt so personal and raw. And I guess like that was my first experience of listening to something that felt so like...
Dad was a difficult guy.
Aye.
I've read his autobiography. I've mentioned it in the show before. It's a really, really good book. Whether or not you're into Meatloaf, it's a very compelling backstory. 17 concussions, including getting his head stuck in a car steering wheel.
Nice.
Because he was checking out a girl's bum.
Quality. So anyway, this record, so I remember being taken by that with a... I think my dad was definitely a much bigger fan of the first record, still is. I think it is. That record's almost peerless, I think. The way I kind of view this record now, looking back on it, is this is obviously an attempt to, like you said, sell a shit ton of records, right? Because he's like not had a hit in ages and ages and ages. And to be fair, having a hit with a song, which I think the radio edit of I Would Dance For Love was like 7 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
So like even having that back then is pretty mad. But yeah, this is basically padded out for a CD, this record, I think. You know, it's why all the songs are longer, it's why there's some stuff in it. Like, if this was shorter, it would have been a much tighter record. If it was the same length as But Out of Hell,
that's
it would have been.
Perhaps true. I still don't think it would have had songs that were up to the same calibre, but it would have been a stronger proposition overall.
I think it's also, like, past it by the time it came out in 93. Yeah. Like, no one was into this shit.
No.
Yeah.
Some of the recording's a bit naff as well. Like, so the guitar tones on it, for example, sound like they're like really midi sort of.
Like, having listened to this in the last couple of days, it's real stinking.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like I've got nostalgia for it.
Of course. But, I get that.
Like, if you're thinking, well, I also was coming in 93. If they didn't have I Would Dance For Love, like, I just would have absolutely.
It's ridiculous
bombed.
When you put it in context of what was actually doing the rounds and stuff.
And to
like
be fair,
that.
The record he put out after that is like Welcome to the Neighbourhood in 95, and that real drop off.
Yeah.
But after that, there's like nothing notable at all.
I would say that for me, the songs that I think are best on are probably I Would Dance For Love. I really like Out of the Frying Pan and the Fire.
You can feel the pulse of the pavement racing like a runaway horse. The subways are steaming and the skin of the streets is a-gleaming with sweat.
I don't know why, it's just got good energy to it.
That was a thing me and my brother used to try drop into conversation at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Got banned from the dinner table, not what to say anymore.
No wonder.
To this day.
What about Life is a Lemon and I Want My Money Back?
Everything's a lie and that's a fact. A lemon and I want my money back.
We used to love that in the car, but like, God, that song fucking sucks.
It feels like slow Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
A lot slow, of this song, slow Jovi.
A lot of it feels like Bon Jovi. I think the ballads are pretty much what this record gets right, I think.
What about school?
It's defective.
What about this album?
So great. What about sex? It's defective. It's never built to really last. What about the family? It's defective. All the batteries are shot. I really like Object. I really like Objects in the rearview mirror, because it's just pure overblown and dramatic and cheesy as fuck. Which
Michael Bay directed the music video for.
He also did I Would Die for Love as well. He did both of them.
Wow! Yep.
Mm-hmm. And it was okay. Just before he did Armageddon. Oh, because when did Armageddon come out? 98.
It must have been
96.
Objects in the Rearview Mirror as well. It has a really good bit in it. See that? They might be gaining ground. Mm-hmm. That kind of bit. There are turns I think I see him peeling out of the dark. I think he's right behind me now, and he's gaining ground. But it was long ago. And it sounds like it's about to do something really brilliant. But then they dial it back again, and it's actually really disappointing, because I think, like, with the first Bat Out of Hell, if that bit had been in there, there would have been a big thing in after it, and it would have totally stuck the landing. But in this, it feels like they just slink out of it, like they pull back. It's quite conservative, and I think that's kind of a shame. Also, this fucking song, they fucking really torture the metaphor in this song.
Absolutely, man, absolutely. Oh my.
If life is a car and love is a glove box and your conscience is a steering wheel.
I think you're overthinking this. just enjoy the tunes, man.
Someone should have thought about it at some point, no.
I mean, some of the vocal performances in the big songs in this are great. Like Objects, there's parts, its vocal range is nuts.
Yeah.
And then the outro is like 4 minutes too long for whatever reason, but like, aye.
So a few other things I want to pick up, I guess, is like, so Everything I've Done, Everything Else, I think is a really, really fun song, but it is not a good song. Yeah. And then Lost Boys and Golden Girls is kind of trying to be the ballad that was on Bat Out of Hell, which we were listening to just before we started, and I can't remember the name of, which I really, really love. Lost Boys and Golden Girls, down on the corner and all around the world.
Heaven can wait.
It's trying to be that, but it totally isn't. But I think it's probably a highlight of the record, of a record which I think is, you know, not particularly good. I want to talk about Wasted Youth for a wee second, right? That little interlude.
Okay.
But I do remember that it had a heart of chrome and a voice like a horny angel. I don't remember if it was a Telecaster or a Stratocaster, but I do remember that it wasn't at all easy.
So I did go to see the musical, Bat Out of Hell musical.
Okay.
And it starts with that.
Okay.
Opens with that.
Well,
as in just a playback or someone actually
saying. No, the guy, the lead who's playing the lead character, I think is supposed to be Peter Pan. I can't remember his name. And the
fucking barmy.
And the fucking in the story, but he's basically immortal. He's an immortal teenager, so he's basically Peter Pan.
Okay.
And it starts with not him, but like his love interest. I think in the version I've seen, he does that. He opens with that. He's like, I remember everything. And it's actually really cool in that context. It works really fucking well. And this mental story that doesn't really make any sense in post-apocalyptic New York with all these songs that like are kind of a vague thread, but it's kind of, it's really bizarre. But there's versions of it when it was originally rolled out in Broadway, it was either love interest, the female protagonist, who's like the daughter of a billionaire who's like a tyrant and like an authoritarian.
This show sounds fucking nuts.
It is fucking nuts. It is brilliant, by the way. It's so good. And all the best songs are in it. All the best Meatloaf songs are in it. And she says that to her dad as her parents are lying in bed. It's quite funny. But yeah, no, that like the songs that they pick from this record are, I think, I Do It For Love, Objects, not the whole song, just part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wasted Youth. Yeah, I think a little bit of Everything Loud and Everything Else. They used to have Good Girls Go to Heaven in some versions of the show, but they removed that. But yeah, there's not a lot of other songs from other Meatloaf records apart from the first couple of bats.
So you recommend the stage show?
Yeah, if you get a chance to see it, it is fucking batshit insane.
I was going
in the best way.
Because it was like 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah. I think I got COVID like the week before it was on, because I was saying there was a girl from my school was performing in it.
Yeah.
I had messaged her being like, oh, what day are you actually playing? And she sent me that, and I was hoping she'd have been like, oh, I'll get you on the guest list. But she's like, tickets are here. And I was like, cool, thanks.
Lagging,
I remember when
Shy Dog gets nae biscuits.
When we were so loads of folk, older guys that sitting around us were like, oh, I only listen to Meatloaf when I'm pissed, and that's all they kept talking about, as if they were kind of pure shame. And I was like, man, just own it. Just own the fact you like Meatloaf, mate, and you need to see a fucking musical based on like a mad story Jim Steinman come up with.
There are a serious number of articles online answering the question what it was that he wouldn't do for love.
He did an SNL sketch about it as well, explaining.
This is fucking mad how many people have really gone into depth on it. I did check out Reddit, and my favourite suggestions were take a COVID vaccine and a guy called GonzoBot had this really earnest answer that went, I just always figured that song was a crude metaphor and that he refers to is bestiality.
And that's an interesting take.
I didn't see the guy's reply going that way, but said it with a straight face. Good luck cutting that for TikTok, Mark.
Oh, brilliant, yeah. one other thing I want to say about the record, and it's also the same as the first Battle of Hell record, is Todd Rundgren's arrangement of the backing vocals is fucking fantastic.
I have to take your word for that. I didn't know he did it.
Like the backing vocals on both those records are insane, like absolutely insane. Whole fucking choir of folk, like, it's brilliant.
Last thing I want to add is just a wee anecdote that I stumbled across about Meatloaf playing in Ireland in a place called Moat, mm-hmm. or Moaty. I don't know how they pronounce it. Have you heard this story?
No.
So some enterprising promoter in Ireland decided to send these really big bands on this tour of like tiny places. So it'd be like us going, be like, your band, Grant, going up and doing like Sky and that, you know, coming down for the big stadiums and things like that and going and doing just the wee shows. And he basically got sent round all these little fucking towns in Ireland, right? And they did it the year after the status quo as well. And these little kind of community halls were fucking rammed with people, like dangerously rammed with people. So Meatloaf's doing this, going around the fucking fucking dirty roads of like west of Ireland and stuff, getting to shows, and they're overfull, like horribly overfull with people that have got absolutely no decorum. There's no like formal security infrastructure. It's just a fucking shambles. But I mean, the band that he had for it, they were like Irish folk that were in the band, and they were great, apparently. The shows were really well played, but they were so busy that he was getting really upset as to how busy the gigs were. And he gets to this third gig in the tour, or fourth gig in the tour, I think it was third, and it's in this town called Moat, M-O-A-T-E. I don't know how that translates. I don't know whether it's in Gaelic. But basically, the gig is fucking heaving, and he's like, could everybody please just pause for a moment and take a few steps back? This is getting really unhealthy. And they're all like, shut the fuck up and play the show. It's like, playing the show, and then fucking things are getting launched at him. And he's like, everybody stop, just come on, it's too busy. Take a few steps back. Anyway, one of the stewards, some guy, intervenes to try and help him, get him off the stage till the crowd can calm down, and the crowd all start fucking heckling him. I think somebody hit him with a shoe or something like that, right? And they're all like, he's really kicking off. And Meatloaf was like a pretty hardy, confrontational guy.
He's a handy guy. Like.
Yeah, if you read his autobiography, you see a lot of that American footballer, all that kind of stuff.
Not afraid of a square go, that boy.
He's out there going, how about you fucking shut up and fucking behave yourselves? And they're like, fuck you. And he's like, fuck you. And he goes off.
This is exactly like a Money Jitchell game.
It is, actually. Yeah. He goes off stage, storms off stage, and he's in the back fucking dressing room, like, punching the walls, fucking raging. And the crowd are going fucking psycho at him, right? And the guy who booked this tour comes out into the room, and he's like, please come back out. And he comes back out. They're all like roaring for him to play, I think it was Battle of Hell. And they're absolutely fucking like bringing the place down, calling for him to play it. He's like, right, I'll play it, but you just need to fucking behave. If one more thing lands in this stage, I'm walking off this stage, right? And they're like, right, yeah, will you behave? Yeah, we'll behave. Right, okay, starts playing the song. And there was things getting chucked about in the room, but they weren't landing on the stage. And anyway, he's fucking playing, and he goes to do this bit of the song. And this is written for the perspective of that security guy that got in the road. He's like, you see Meatloaf's face react as he catches at the corner of his eye the sight of something flying towards him, and it's really shiny. It's a fucking wheelchair. And he tries to bat it out the air, and he falls back through all the drums and the drum riser, and a fucking full empty wheelchair lands on the stage.
Tremendous.
And he walks off, storms off again. I fucking told you, storms off. They follow him backstage, and some fucking random Irish bloke for the crowd comes in, and he's like, "Here you, I paid a lot to come to this show, fucking get out there." And Meatloaf's like, "Fuck you." And the guy goes to hook him in the jaw, and this poor fucking security guy sticks his face in the road, gets his nose all smashed up and broken for the rest of his life, because this Irish guy calls him out instead of knocking out Meatloaf. And then they usher Meatloaf away onto a bus to the next wee fucking town.
Mm-hmm. And what year was this?
I don't know. I'm guessing it was the 80s, early 80s.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
Now I'm going to look up for that. And, yeah. No YouTube footage, obviously, but...
Amazing. Fucking wheelchair. Right, okay, Grant.
See, before we move on, I want to mention one other thing. Lorraine Crosby, do you know who that is?
Yeah, that's Mrs. Loud.
Yeah, so she did the guide track for the vocal on I Would Do It For Love, which became the actual track for the song.
Yeah,
and she ended up not getting credited in the record or paid for it.
Yeah, they called her Mrs. Loud.
Yeah, yeah. It's horrible. Apparently they were going to have Cher or Bonnie Tyler or Melissa Etheridge do it, but they decided to go with the guide track.
I Would Do Anything For Love But I Won't Do That is actually lifted from a Bonnie Tyler song.
Was it written by Jim Steinman? Mm-hmm. Probably was.
It was, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was the song's called Getting So Excited. Right, what are we doing next, Grant? Oh, we're doing it in chronological, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know where that takes us to then. Back in Black by AC/DC.
Little known records out of Australia.
By the way, just want to clarify, chronological in Grant's life, not chronological in year of release, before anybody that's tuned in halfway or hasn't been paying attention freaks out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you discovered this when you were at 12 or 13, you said?
So I think off the back...
Back in Black?
No. Off the back of getting really into Meatloaf, obviously my folks then started buying me they obviously had old ones as well, like kind of classic rock stuff, but not like Mojo magazine, but those sort of like rock magazine compilation CDs and stuff like that. So I got all that. And my stepdad is actually a massive AC/DC fan, so he had all of his old ones. So again, AC/DC was one of the first CDs I actually bought, because I wanted the newer one, because... I don't know if you've ever bought an AC/DC CD. I
have not.
From years ago, this would have been 2004-ish. So the CDs, if you put them into your computer and went on the website, it logged you into a certain thing. You could see a bunch of interviews and videos and photos and stuff and set lists. So it doesn't seem that exciting now, I will give you that. And I think they were kind of shit. They didn't really work. But the idea of it was still owning your own thing, even though my stepdad had a Back in Black CD, it was owning your own thing. Going on the internet, getting more access with it and stuff like that. It was something that was really cool. But yeah, I think Back in Black was the first one that I listened to, and I was like, oh, this is... Because they were this is the biggest selling album of all time.
Second.
But at the time, though, it was the biggest selling album of all time. And yeah, just I am unironically a massive AC/DC fan as well. A lot of the stuff in the 80s I could take or leave, but the rest of it's all pretty fun.
This came up in the Black Sabbath episodes as well, where Mark cast doubt on whether they had anything else that was good after this point.
Yeah, I don't think that's an unpopular opinion.
The record after Back in Black is
For Those About to Rock, We Salute You.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's pretty famous. I don't know if it's good, but I certainly know the name.
And then
don't you know being famous means you're good?
Right.
That's the one thing that's been missing for my whole life.
Yeah.
I've never put
Is the
two,
inverse also
those
true?
Those two things together.
So this was, Back in Black was their seventh record. AC/DC would become the first band since the Beatles to have four consecutive number one albums.
Nice. Good for them.
So this was the first album with Brian Johnson after Bon Scott died. In the same year, 1980, the band needed a replacement Johnson. if you know, you know.
Hey.
Bon Scott died of alcohol poisoning after a binge in London.
Yeah, in his car?
His friend's car. He died in the back of a Renault 5. Oofed. That's some way to go. Yeah. The coroner apparently said that he choked and vomit, but his death was recorded as acute alcohol poisoning. And he was not very involved in the writing of this, Bon Scott. He didn't sing in it. He actually played drums in the demos, though, because Bon Scott was a drummer. So the original demos of some of the tracks off this were him. And the cover art, the back in black, the whole thing is a tribute to him. I think presumably there must be some element of that in the bells at the start as well for Hell's Bells.
Oh yeah, I mean, they played that at his funeral.
Okay, well. Also, apparently the band had to negotiate the grey outlining on the lettering because the record label were really unhappy. And it just really reminds me of Spinal Tap.
Yeah, yeah. That's got to be black and black cover.
But there's a lot of like Spinal Tap similarities here, because for example, you know, the lyrics, you know, it's sort of alongside Led Zeppelin with lines like, "Let me put my love into you, babe, let me cut your cake with my knife." It, you know, it's very ploughing up your bean fields,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Lots of them on this record.
I mean, I think they should probably have just stuck with Bon Scott for this record and vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Controversial opinion there.
I hate the singing in AC/DC, especially from this era onwards. Fucking hate it.
Oh, it doesn't change.
It constantly is at a point where his head's going to fucking crack open, man. I can't deal with it. Highway to Hell had also been recorded by Mutt Lange, as was this. Mutt Lange, who married Shania Twain.
Good for him.
It was recorded in the Bahamas.
Yes.
But it was actually quite far from idyllic. They described the place as concrete cells that they had to lock at night to prevent robberies. They were given spears by the landlady in case anybody tried to break in. One recording session was interrupted by a crab running across the floor.
Yeah, apparently the recording environment in the rooms was so stark that they could actually fucking hear the crab, which is insane. It was so dry. Like, how the fuck do you even hear that? And, like, can you just imagine being there? It's like, there's a noise. Like, I can't figure out what the noise is.
That's definitely a crab, mate. That's a crab. I recognise that. Yeah, severe storms also disrupted the first few days, and they're mentioned in the opening lyrics. Aye. Yeah, so it came on the back of Highway to Hell, commercial breakthrough for them at the time.
You didn't mention the bell.
Oh, they had to get it cast.
They tried
to record the church, but the birds kept flying away from it. Yeah,
brilliant.
This has sold more than 50 million copies. It's listed as the second biggest selling album ever behind Thriller and ahead of The Bodyguard official soundtrack at number 3. It's the third biggest seller in the USA, so I'm not sure what comes in there to upset that.
It's probably the same, just different order.
Mm. Certified platinum 27 times, best-selling album to ever not reach number one in US history. They toured for a full year after it was released.
Just a year.
Yeah.
They're still touring the latest record, and it came out almost 5 years ago.
They take 6 days off between every show now, yeah. So that's why it takes so fucking long.
Yeah. We spoke about that though as well during Black Sabbath. I mean, they were putting out 2 albums a year, so for bands to take that long at this time was actually quite unusual. Yes, I know we're used to Metallica going in like an 18-month world tour now, but like at this point, bands like Beach Boys, 4 albums in a year, Black Sabbath, 2 albums in a year for 2 years consecutively. Yeah. Bands released the album, did some shows, went back, started working on the next album. They were touring for a year in the back of this, which was pretty exceptional.
Because they, up until this point, they'd released an album a year since 1976.
Yeah.
So this was like their fifth record.
I think one of the albums is maybe like a live one or something. But yeah, like it was a record came out every year from 76.
So what do you like about AC/DC, Grant?
Well, what's not to like? It's meat and potatoes, isn't it?
It's meat and potatoes. It's 12 bar blues. I mean, I never got AC/DC at all. Never in the slightest bit got into AC/DC. I'm on record as really disliking Led Zeppelin, but I can at least...
I agree with that.
I can at least get with some Led Zeppelin tracks. No Quarter, Immigrant Song a wee bit, but I cannot get with any AC/DC tracks.
Don't get me wrong, I listened to this the other day for coming in, and I forgot how much I don't like Shoot to Thrill. It's become one of those songs that it's like kind of jingles for like sports teams. Aye. And that Iron Man soundtrack fucking did it to death as well.
My flatmate Rosie was like, is that CSI? I was listening to it earlier on. It makes me think of ZZ Top and The Who. You know, those are bands that do that kind of blues, kind of 70s, 80s blues rock thing that just fucking leaves me really cold. We'll talk about the tracks in a second, a wee bit, but All Night Long, I think, is by far the best tune on this record.
Oh, that's great.
Because it's got the chorus that actually works. But yeah, just, I think listening to AC/DC is like, it really puts me in the solid, as in the Solid Rock Cafe in Glasgow, having like aftershocks and Jägermeister spilt on me. It's a stodgy metal pub soundtrack to me, and I don't get it.
Interesting. So what is it you like about it?
Well, it's not to like. Yeah, I think it was just like, similar to how I got into the Meatloaf record, I think it was just something that I really connected with because it was like so simple, and I probably hadn't listened to a lot of music intensively up until that point. Mm-hmm. I was also like learning how to play the drums, so a lot of this was like playing the drums along to it because they were so simple, but they had like little turnarounds and stuff. So it's all that, it's probably more nostalgic. And then again, it was one of the first CDs I bought. And then I started buying all the ones before Back in Black. And then I didn't listen to anything else for a very long time. So I was like, surely it won't get any better than this.
Yeah, I mean...
And I was right.
It's very much a band. Like, this is, you've got all you need from this. It's like a bit like Sabbath as well. So you've got all you need. You don't really need much more than this than these few records, you know?
And the first time I went to like a stadium show was to see AC/DC in 2009 on the Black Ice World Tour. And it was all the original members, minus Bon Scott, obviously.
How was it?
Very similar to the Meatloaf one. I remember having a great time, but in hindsight, it was kind of shite because the sound is awful. Mm. But I mean, Angus Young would have been like 54, 55 at the time, and he did like the Let There Be Rock was like a fucking 27 minute long track with the guitar solo that's 10 minutes, and he was on a wee Spyro thing that spins up and shit. And it's like, I was still maybe only, 16 at that point? So it was still just like very like, holy fuck, like shows can be like this.
That sounds
surrounded by folk. Covered in Tenants and Dunshing and Hampton, you know what I mean?
A 10-minute solo, 27-minute long AC/DC song. Fucking hell, I would confess to terrorism.
So the other thing is I also got really into like, because my stepdad had all the old videos, so I had like No Bull and like Live at Donington and stuff, so all like the kind of early 90s live videos of AC/DC.
Yeah.
And I actually tried to get Chris to buy my other ticket to go and see them in London last year.
That's right.
I got a very polite no. I ended up punting my tickets because I couldn't go anyway. Right. But the thing that decided for me was I watched Let There Be Rock from Donington in 91, and I'm like, they won't be fucking anything like that. And I've met Chris Slade, who was the drummer for AC/DC in the 90s, because Phil Rudd was probably being a bad boy back then as well. And Chris Slade is not a great drummer, right? Or he's not like a technically proficient drummer, because he was in a drum shop in Glasgow, and he was showing like some wee boy how to do like a paradiddle. And this guy was at his then was like, can I barely do a fucking paradiddle? And he heard him, and he's like, I can do this though. And he sat a kit and he played the Let There Be Rock beat, which is all just like single eights at like 190, 200 BPM, and he played it, and he just played it for like 2 minutes. And the guy was like, I fair enough. Because it's like, honestly, I'll send you the video from them, Let There Be Rock. You don't need to watch all 22 minutes of it, whatever.
Thank God.
But the endurance to play that with like the intensity is fucking nuts. So yeah, I just like got really into that stuff, and it was like kind of, I also started listening to a lot of rock compilations and shit, but I think just like Back in Black was the first one where I was like, I like this. It's not heavy music, but it's like,
I mean,
rock, let's call it that.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, other folk at my school were into like Metallica and Zeppelin and shit, and I fucking hated all of that, and I still cannot get my head around any of that stuff.
Yeah, I will say like AC/DC were very rarely offensively bad. As much as I was never a fan, I was just like, that's AC/DC. They do what they do. There's bands that I find actively uncomfortable to listen to. They're just like, yeah, whatever. It's just totally unmoved.
See
me.
A few jars in you. Whoa. It comes
well,
on.
Well, it's funny you mention that because that isn't quite bad taste. So is putting a song called Have a Drink on Me on the album when your singer has just died of alcohol poisoning in the same year and the cover is supposedly a fucking tribute to him.
Woke hadn't happened yet though.
Yeah. Yeah. What a fucking tone deaf bunch of fucking munters, right? But it turns out there's actually quite a big controversy about this. So the lyrics, for example, are, "So come on, have a good time and get blinded out of your mind. So don't worry about tomorrow, take it today. Have a drink of me, have a drink of me," blah, blah, blah. Far Out Mag
poetry.
has a feature about it. And they said that apparently it's a bit divisive among fans, that they also felt it was pretty disrespectful. It could be viewed as straying either way. It's either an overt urge for celebrating and honouring Bon Scott the only way, or it's astonishingly fucking heartless. They definitely went for it though. We're putting that one on it. I mean, surely at some point somebody must have said, "Whoa, guys, bit too soon. Same year that he's died. Same year.
Wait till the body's cold at least."
Yeah. I mean, there you go. I mean, which of the tunes in it really grab you? As I said, I think All Night Long is the best track here, but there's plenty of famous ones.
I mean, Hell's Bells actually sounds a bit like Lungfish, who are the AC/DC of the Discord
that's an interesting
bands. So,
comparison.
If you want to do all 16 Lungfish records,
No.
Maybe next year.
Yeah, all the big ones. I was totally obsessed with all of it when I was younger. I think I like them all equally enough, apart from like, "You Shoot Me All Night Long" is obviously like an actual big Clash rock song. But "I Shoot to Thrill" has just become like unlistenable for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just been, was that an episode you guys did about songs that cease to become actual
music
anymore? Yeah. Because they're just like adverts or jingles or whatever.
Memed out of existence.
I "Shoot to Thrill" has become that for me, and I actually can't listen to it anymore. So
fair enough. I don't know, I'm not a huge fan of AC/DC generally, but I think this record is great sequencing. I think the songs are really good for what they are, like probably the best of what they are actually, which is just like simple bluesy rock and roll. There's some good hooks on them. Angus Young and Malcolm Young knew how to write a really good simple catchy riff, which is hard. Yeah, it's fine. Like, they're fine. They are what they are. They're AC/DC, you know.
It's a pint of Tennent's.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Tennent's and totally, ties.
It's a pint of Tennent's, man. That is.
You're not excited about it, but when you have it, you're like, that's all it.
I wouldn't turn it off.
Scottish water.
You know? Scottish water.
See where Bon Scott was going. Exactly. How's that Scottish water, was it then?
Moni were playing Aberdeen last year or whatever, and we came off at Kirriemuir to go and see the statue and get a photo of it.
Nice.
He's a very short stature. I don't think he was that short in real life, but
yeah, I mean, like I said, I wouldn't turn it off if it was on, you know.
I unfortunately missed the sale when Umbro was doing a collab with AC/DC for the 1978 Scottish football kit.
Oh, really?
Because they played the Apollo. My stepdad was at that show in 78 at the Apollo, which is now gone. It's now Walkabout. And that's when Scotland had just bet Holland. And I can't remember.
Or beaten. Bit of Scots in there.
Was that the World Cup or was that Euros or something in 78? I don't know what it was.
Italy in 90, that'd be 70, that'd be the World Cup, yeah. Pretty too young for this.
It doesn't
matter. It's one of the few things I'm too young for.
Scotland won at the football, so all AC/DC came out wearing the Scotland football top. And so if you want Blood, You've Got It, is a live album they released in 79 that's then playing at the Apollo in Glasgow. So for the anniversary of that in 2018 or 2019, they brought out Umbro AC/DC Scottish football tops and gutties and stuff like that, and all sold out well before I could get any of it.
That's
pretty cool though, to be fair.
So if anyone's cool listening to this and sees it on eBay or has one, I will buy it, size medium.
Well, we move on to your third and final choice.
Yeah. Unless there's any other hot takes on AC/DC that you want to...
No, I think they've all been made.
Don't get me wrong, anything they released in this century is fucking rubbish. Even Rock and Roll Train.
Even Rock and Roll Train.
That was like the big single that like everyone was like, they're back. It's fucking shit. Anyway.
Okay, so this is The Shape of Punk to Come, a chimerical bombination in 12 bursts from 1998 by the Scandinavian post-hardcore, hardcore something or other band Refused, fronted by Dennis Lixon.
Yep.
That silly pretentious album name, I think the extended title gives a sense of the hybrid nature of the record though. A chimerical bombination in 12 bursts, chimerical indeed. A couple of bits of background on this, there was no Pro Tools used in it. It was made using Soundscape. And by the way, fucking Nostalgia Central, Soundscape, I hadn't thought about that program in a long fucking time. It was one of the only like kind of sound editing softwares that you could get your hands on for a long bit.
The tracking period. Technique was weird, was interesting, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, so they recorded it on tape. This is the drums specifically. They then transferred that and worked those recordings down on the computer, and then they transferred the edited things back onto tape for the band to then do their tracking, a guitar, bass, etc. over. It wasn't at any point quantized, so it wasn't locked in, which gives it a bit of a collage-y feel without being locked into grids, which I think probably lends the album a lot of its personality. It doesn't feel too assembled, even though it clearly does have a collage kind of approach. And it probably, if you were actually to check it, it probably drifts quite a bit. I'd imagine some of the edits aren't precise because, again, there was no quantization in it. It was just visual and sort of like approximations. But it's a very, very interestingly put together record. Very, very well put together record as well. Really, really well recorded, I think.
I agree.
So that's us. When did you get to this?
So I'll give the context. Bouncing off of like being into AC/DC, I was probably the odd one in my group that when all the guys were into like Metallica and like Zeppelin and like other classic shit, and I was like more into AC/DC. If I read off some of the list of bands that I was into before I first discovered Refused, so Avenged Sevenfold, Biffy Clyro, Rise Against, Atreyu, Quoting Cambria, Airborne, LOL. Which, do you know Airborne?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
They are AC/DC.
Effectively. I saw them once at the Academy. It was genuinely very fun.
But yeah, again, I can imagine they're probably a lot of fun. Like,
it was a lot of fun. Tenacious D, who Meatloaf was in the second album. He's the dad.
Yeah, nice.
I saw coming back. Yep. Linkin Park, Alexis and Fire, Fun for Friend, Band of Horses. Wee bit of RDM. There was an RDM compilation CD in my work, my first job. So I literally listened to RDM for hours and hours at the weekend. So I was into that kind of shit. And I remember...
It's exactly the same kind of shit. I was into roughly the same age.
And I don't know if you were the same, always having like Kerrang on. And it was just kind of whatever bands were cycling through that. Because I had Kerrang magazine and shit. So that's kind of stuff you were buying. Yeah. And New Noise came on. Like, because the music video for that is quite interesting as well, compared to the stuff that was coming out in like late noughties or whatever.
Yeah, I remember when the music video came out, like all those haircuts that they had in the early 2000s were because of that fucking music video.
Yeah, and the shirt, the like the painted nails and the shirts and the jumpers and like even the ties.
I was actually around at that time, you weren't, I guess.
I was listening to Meatloaf at that point. You were a bit younger. So yeah, I saw this music video and I went into my music class, and the way I've written this is much better. It was a guy who's into obscure music in my music class who always wore big skate shoes and had a Converge hoodie on, had blue and green dyed hair. And I'd asked him if he'd heard of this band called Refused. And he's like, oh, he explained Shape of Punk to Come, blah, 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 blah. That guy was David Scott, who's the guitarist in Money Jitcher with me.
And that's what you guys kind of...
That's how we kind of met. I knew who he was, but that was the thing that I spoke about to him in the class. And then he gave me a pen drive and it was just full of like stuff like The Smiths, Botch, Brand New, New York Hotel, Fugazi. Like, he gave me a bunch of stuff being like, oh, if you like that, you'll like this.
Yeah.
But out of all the stuff like he gave me, like Refused was just like going through. And I think because obviously, I think they brought out like a 10-year CD that year as well. So I don't know if that's why it was getting played in Kerrang, but I was just taken aback by how I thought that was like the newest thing that had just came out, and to find out it was like 12 years old at that point, and then went through all their back stuff and was just like obsessed with them for like years after that.
You mentioned Fugazi there. So the band have cited Fugazi, they've cited Snapcase, Born Against, Nation of Ulysses, amongst many others. I think you can hear a lot of those at various points just in this record. They also credit the band Ink and Dagger with the inspiration behind some of the weird dancey kind of experimental cuts that they do.
They had a big influence on Glassjaw as well, Ink and Dagger.
Supposedly this album also came after the band had developed a real hard one for Slayer, although I don't really hear it all that much, but it's a consistently recurring theme in the interviews and stuff. But Dennis's vocal picture in this record is very like Sam McPheeters of Born Against. The song Summer Holiday versus Punk Routine, I think, could have been a Fugazi track. The title track in particular has a completely Ian MacKay vocal part in that. Right, backing vocal. Protest Song 86, the drum intro is really Snapcase. It's also a highlight, but it's very Snapcasey.
Oh, it's all the guitars in this record are very, very Snapcase. Yeah. And they used to tour together as well quite a bit, I think.
Yeah, and so I saw some mentions as well about just before the Umeå hardcore phenomenon went into full bloom. So Umeå was a city in Sweden that we've spoken about a few times, which was just really disproportionately productive for big bands. This band was seen as part of that. It was all centred around a kind of a youth music venue called Galaxen up there, where a lot of these bands played. Cult of Luna and that all played in there as well. In fact, so did bands like Meshuggah. They kind of came for that kind of background as well. There's a documentary out there if you're interested in the Umeå scene that Refused and Cult of Luna and Meshuggah and all that stem from. It's called UXA, as in like, you know, hardcore UXA. Oh, okay. That covers that scene in a bit of detail, if you can find it, that is. And all the Refused members were all vegan straight edge until they split in 1998. They no longer are and have reformed, but they were until 1998. According to Vice, writing about them at the time, Refused stood at the nexus of modern punk, incorporating all of its subgenres into one scattered but neat package. And the AV Club described Shape of Punk to come, the Shape of Pump to come.
That's next week, guy.
That's that AC/DC record, right?
They described it as an undisputed classic that served as a rallying cry for bands longing to incorporate sounds from outside the walls of aggressive music. So like I said, that kind of pretentious title of a chimerical bombination in 12 bursts. They are really aware of the fact that there was a real departure in this record. Like, we're going to put in all these little segues and all these little bits. We're going to have these little sort of bridges and songs that are completely odd genres, jazz and bits of electronica and bits of like sort of rallying speeches and all these kind of things. It is very collage-y in its texture.
We've spoken about that, haven't they? Like, there was a deliberate choice to try and they thought that punk music just wasn't punk because it had just been so mainstreamized. And
we need to do something totally different.
You know?
What did it tell us? Like, the shape of what did it tell us about what was going to be the shape of punk to come? You know, what were the takeaway themes? I think that it told us that they felt punk was going to be more formless, like less bound to genre tropes and conventions, like you're saying, that it could even extend to other genres entirely. You know, that punk could be electronic, punk could be jazz. They were trying to sort of almost redefine it as a mindset or an ideology rather than a music or a fashion style per se. I think they were telling us that punk was also going to, in their opinion, double down on the radical sort of anti-establishment, especially left-aligned politics. I think they felt very optimistic about that. I would say from this album, I had a lot of love for this album, like a lot of love for this album. It was a really, I think we probably can't overstate how important New Noise was in the success of this album, because that video was pretty like breathtaking.
It's iconic.
Yeah, it's iconic. Yeah. It was a real like breath of fresh air in an almost Smells Like Teen Spirit-y kind of fashion. Now, I don't mean they didn't go on as a band to be as commercial or as whatever as that, but it had a similar kind of like, fucking hell, have you seen that, man? That is so different and it's so exciting and just, not just the arrangement. I mean, the song itself is a very iconically written song for people that are into kind of punk and hardcore stuff, but the delivery, the changes, the speed, the aggression, like the hookiness of it as well, like, it was a real masterstroke.
Do you think he was trying to get us to cover that? And I'm like, nah, mate.
Yeah, it's a poor good luck. No. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just, it feels so passé now to even play that song. You know what I mean? If you're a musician, because it's been done so many fucking times.
It is also like, a bit Smells Like Teen Spirit in that sense. Yeah, what's the point? But I think that was very important to the success of this album. But this album had some very lofty ideas, as did Refused as a band, as did the International Noise Conspiracy, who we spoke about. And we're going to touch upon an episode that we did in the past here called the Red Menace Mixtape, which was looking at communist themes in successful bands. So Rage Against Machine, we already spoke about Tom Morello earlier on, doing huge shows for Live Nation alongside people that sign missiles. We spoke about on that show
The Coup,
the hip hop group. And we spoke about International Noise Conspiracy, which is a spin-off of Refused, and just very fucking jingoistic communist moon, all that kind of stuff. And I hear a lot of that in this as well. So I think amongst the positive takeaways, their predictions for what punk was going to become, I think punk was also set to become quite jingoistic in their opinion, which it kind of did. You know, American, what's that Green Day album?
American Idiot
and stuff, you know, like kind of like soundbitey and a bit patronising and quite shallow. I think punk was going to become somewhat spoken from a position of privilege as well. And by that, I mean like affluent Scandinavians romanticising the abstract notion of communism versus, for example, Eastern Europeans, Africans, Latin Americans describing their lived experience of the realities of communism. I mean, this is like a common meme. I was watching a YouTube video, a really, really good blogger is from Russia. He's moved away from Russia, but talking about the perspective that generations of Eastern Europeans in particular have on Western Europeans that romanticise communism, and they're like, the fuck are you talking about? Honestly, it's such a position of privilege to be able to romanticise what we went through and what our families went through. That apparently, by the way, just as an aside, is starting to fade a little, because we're now into a generation, even in Eastern Europe, where the legacy of that isn't as apparent anymore, because those generations that went through it firsthand are dying out. So it's now sort of getting a little bit of its romance back, but that's only because the lived memory is starting to fade a little bit. But I think I always felt that this album, well, not always felt, initially I bought into it hook, line and sinker, that kind of 98 to 2003 period where I was reading Chomsky and, you know, really like single-minded in my left-wing opinions. I still hold a lot of those left-wing opinions. Most of them are left-wing opinions, but they're a lot more nuanced. And Refused, a bit like Noam Chomsky, didn't age all that well, because it seemed myopic, it seemed kind of jingoistic, it seemed very self-involved, took itself very seriously, it was kind of pretty patronising at points. And that aspect of the band, I don't think, has aged all that well.
Are you conflating that aspect of the band with the International Noise Conspiracy, though?
Yeah, well, the International Noise Conspiracy were much more overt in the things that in the titles, the tracks and stuff, but it is all here in Refused originally. Like, the messaging, the lyrics are all very, like, to the barricades type stuff. Like, protest song 68 is all about the far-left uprisings in Europe, across Europe, you know, West Germany, Paris, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's aged very well musically, but it hasn't aged very well thematically, and it feels like a bit...
Well, also because they came back, and that, I think that was...
And that's the other thing. Yeah, they came back, and it just seemed so ill-advised for a band of that sort of, like, highfalutin kind of idealism.
Well, how they left it, because obviously by the time I got into them, they'd been long gone, but they had the whole manifesto about, like, we'll never come back and monetize us or glorify
it. And it was, like, the ultimate romance,
and it's like
as well.
For that catalogue to be a definitive, like, how many records? Was that 3 records?
Yeah, this anyway. Might just be the truth. And Songs to Fan the Flames. Songs to
Fan the Flames of Discontent.
And then this was a third record.
And then, so that was when the CD came out that I got as well. It's got all the live footage and the documentary and shit like that. And I think because it was this sort of, like, time capsule of it all, it felt so important. I mean, I agree with some of the way their stance and how much they, like, were dying the hill for it. It's not aged well, whatever. But at the time, I remember just thinking that period of them was so fascinating. And then they came back and they kind of were, like, ripping themselves off for that first album.
Yeah.
And then it's, like, unlistenable stuff after that.
Yeah.
I did see them in 2019.
So they were Thrice and the Baris.
Yes.
I thought they were pretty boring, to be honest.
I thought it was pretty good, but it's the same thing of, like, I guess it's, like, slight nostalgia bringing up. I mean, all the new stuff was bad, but they closed with New Noise and it was fucking great. And they, like, did, like, a real kind of, wasn't like 10 minutes, but they did a longer version. So I'm glad I've seen them. And obviously they're now doing their farewell tour and they put out that album in November, and it's folk covering this album as well.
Yeah, which is, I think, is pretty good, actually. Some good cover.
Some interesting takes on it. The Jill version sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty fun. But yeah, I think it was a thing, if they never actually came back, they would have been maybe the guarded in a better light.
Yeah, I think their legacy would have been secured.
I think their legacy is still secured, to be honest, man. Musically,
not in the same way,
like,
I guess.
I disagree.
Musically, I think, like, this record still stands. Nobody ever talks about the new records when they talk about issues. Like, they obviously, it feels as though, yes, I agree, it's an advice to come back. But I think the legacy of what they'd created musically on this record, it still sounds very current and... Almost, it could almost came out yesterday, do you know what I mean? So I think our legacy is assured.
It's kind of timeless, actually. I feel like it's only a handful of records I can think of off the top of my head. If you let someone listen to that and be like, guess when that came out, and they would actually be like, oh, I actually can't. Maybe production wise, now you could kind of pick.
The production's really good, isn't it?
I mean, it's great, but maybe someone could guess it's the 90s, but actually, if you were like, oh, this came out 5 years ago, folk would be like, I believe that.
It is interesting that The Shape of Punk to Come, they were also somewhat forecasting, maybe unintentionally, that punk would be quite heavily produced. Because this is, I don't mean this is heavily produced in the sense that it's bad or that it loses its energy. I just mean it's a studio project.
Yeah, well, it's got a lot more thought in the production than which most punk records would have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's quite a long way away from a lot of punk. You know what I mean? So there's an interesting sort of unintended message in there. I agree. I think, as I said, I think Refused, my idolising the Refused for that period of time between like 98 and 2003 or whatever, it feels a little bit naive, and it makes me feel a wee bit like mugged off because of them coming back, and also just the messaging and the single-mindedness. I feel the same about Noise Conspiracy. However, musically, I do think it really stands up. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting decisions on it though, and there's some stuff that actually in hindsight I don't like as much. I think Liberation Frequency, which I loved at the time, but as a wee bit of a one-trick pony in hindsight, you know, quiet and then super loud and then quiet and then super loud. Also, I think I've said this to you before, don't you think he sounds like James Dean Bradfield in the verse?
Yeah.
Mm. It's so fucking weird. I think Worms of Senses, Faculties of the Skull, that first song that they do, loads of good ideas, loads of riffs, loads of good segments. But it's probably like the least cohesive track, and actually one of the most challenging tracks, because it has so many different things happening in it. And I always thought it was a kind of not an obvious choice to be the first track on this. Like Summer Holiday, for example, would have been a fucking huge opening track in terms of just being a massive big hooky thing. That I think is the best song on this record. I think it's got that balance of like intensity, but just it's not trying too hard. There's just something about it, and it's not too preachy as well. It's great for dancing, which was really hard to find in this genre at the time. You know, if you were trying to do like a kind of alternative disco, you could put like One Armed Scissor on, maybe, but even then it was kind of shite for dancing. Could maybe put on some Les Savvy Fav, depended, but you could put that on and it was fucking great. It was like a proper jumping tune. It's some great confusing little drum fills in that song as well that I don't think it gets credit for.
Kind of going back to what I was saying as well, having listened back to this over the last couple of days, I've subconsciously scooped a fair bit off David.
I can't remember the guy's name.
I nearly said Sandstorm. That's another episode.
That's from Finland.
I mean, I guess I listened to it right at the age where it's kind of listen back to it. Some of it seems a bit sort of like cringe, and maybe like the dance sections and stuff. Or like a bit. I think it was always kind of tongue in cheek and things. Anyway, but
was it you said the shy dog gets no biscuits?
Shagger. Yeah.
Well, I agree. It's a bit whatever, but they had to do it and they had to try it. And fuck knows, man. I mean, it had a huge impact. I did wonder if maybe, you know, saying that they said that they were really influenced by Slayer, the Deadly Rhythm. I think Snapcase, but maybe the Slayer bit is in the riff of that at the start. I'm not sure, because that's kind of an unusual sound that they've got going on there. That's the one that's got the jazz intro, and then it reprises with a really jazz bit in the bridge as well, which is kind of interesting. The Refuse Party Program track. Fucking brilliant, raging hardcore
that's
track.
That's my favourite song on the record.
I mean, the flabby, kind of noisy electronic ending. I mean, if you're going to be a pedant about it, it doesn't need to be there, but it's
only 2 minutes and 38 seconds long, so, you know.
Yeah, the song itself's only 1 minute and 38 seconds long, though. Yeah. Protest song 68, that's fucking lefty bingo, innit? Tanky bingo.
Yep.
The opening drum part, I think, is one of my favourite beats ever. It's absolutely fucking brilliant, that bit. Refuse They're Fucking Dead, which obviously as well was like when they split up, that was such a perfect...
Well, that was the documentary as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. So, wider form. I think it's one of the slices of real originality. That does help this age well. It keeps the album musically feeling relevant. I think the fact that the vocal as well, he can't help but lapse into melody on it. It's quite a nice little reprieve. I would say it's very rarely I ever got to the end of this record. I think like the Tannhäuser thing is okay, but it's very long and drawn out. It's quite a nice idea, but it just a bit protracted. And the Apollo program was a hoax. First of all, I've no idea how ironic that title was or was not meant to be, but I just find the song really kind of unnecessary. So that last section of the record, it never worked for me. I always kind of zoned out from about the end of track 9.
I always thought the last two tracks are them flexing that they can do like more dynamic stuff.
Yeah.
That they're not just like Snapcase or something that is like, we just do riffs and like quiet and loud and stuff. Because yeah, like the Apollo hoax thing. They just start off with just the guitar and they were going to add more, and then they were like, actually, maybe that's more interesting. Like,
I'm pretty sure there's like a Rise Against cover of that or something like out there.
Yeah, Touche Amore have
done
one.
Touche Amore have done on your record, yeah.
Saying that, so like when I got the CD, obviously you get like the documentary and there's a bunch of live footage. See, when you see them doing like Tannhäuser live, it's fucking like, it's a different song entirely. Depends how long they took to write this album, sorry. I wonder if it could have became something else.
Yeah.
But like the way they could do that song, and it would have like really long sections and nothing in the middle, and then it would all come back at the end, and like drummer was like throwing his kit about and stuff, and like none of it seemed contrived as well. I think they genuinely it was just this like the showy time period where it was all, it seemed so intense, so it made sense. Like when the fact they all quit, it all made sense because it must have been such a horrible band to be in, I think. Like, I got that vibe from the documentary anyway.
I think they were also a bit fucked off with the fact that it was met with like poor critical and commercial success. It was very misunderstood at the time, you know.
I love that video of them playing the pub in Ireland, and they got there on the tables like playing and like doing like, I think it is Liberation Transmission, and like everyone's just having pints and not even looking at them and stuff. And I was like, they just cared so much about it, but didn't give a fuck that no one was actually paying attention. There's also a live footage of them doing The Shape of Punk to Come, which is like the kind of disco beat start.
Yeah.
And they play the first like minute of the song, and then when it kicks in heavy on the actual second chorus, they cut the backing track and the band actually come in live. It must have been so fun to play that.
Yeah.
And there's not much footage of it, because obviously I think they only toured for like, don't know, however many months before they quit. But like all of that stuff, I just thought was like, I'd never seen another band do all that shit. And I just thought it was so fucking cool.
I'm like pretty severe on Refused, just because I felt disappointed that I had been so drawn in by this idealism. And actually, as I've gotten older, I'm like just a bit scunnered with some of that patter.
I agree now. It's more like when you, I was like 17.
Yeah, no. Oh, but what I'm saying is I felt like in hindsight it made them seem a little bit like detached and a little bit, as I say, privileged, a little bit like, oh, these fucking rich Scandinavians like putting on this sort of like show, you know. But at the same time, I feel like I'm probably being unfair, because there's so many bands going back that have made these really naive piss and vinegar records full of like overstated things that, even though they're very flawed, ended up being really vital parts of like popular culture and music culture and alternative culture. And I think this is, for all that I'm leveling criticisms at it, they're small criticisms compared to the footprint that this left on so many musicians. Like the three of us here in this room have all significantly changed our songwriting because of this, whether we're aware of it or not. It's had you've brought it for that very reason, but it's just, there's no point denying it. It had a big, big influence. So I do want to put an asterisk when I mention Refused, and especially because of their fucking reunion, which was a terrible idea. But you can't take away from how fucking great this record
was. I mean, I think it's one of the most important records I've ever written. And yeah, I don't really give too much of a fuck about the political messaging behind it. I never did at the time really either. And I'm quite lefty. It always struck me as being a bit, I guess when I was getting into it, it was like early 2000s. They'd been gone for a while. The messaging, I'd already like had my fill of the Manics and their slogan even. So I was like, I'm pretty much done with anything propaganda, I guess, wise, if you want to put it that way. But this music, this record is one of the most important things that I ever listened to, for sure. I think it's one of the most important records ever written.
It must have been fucking weird if they ever did it. Refused or International Noise Conspiracy going to the likes of Prague, or somewhere in Poland, and singing these fucking songs about communist men and fucking...
I'm sure they will have done.
And I'm sure they can find the squat scenes that will make it possible for them to do that. But see, in terms of like how that shit goes down there, it's not as well as you would think.
It's probably worth saying here that this came out in 98, and by 2000 it had sold 28,000 copies. Before that, not long after it came out, it only managed to rack up 1,400 in the time of the CD.
That's mad. That's like a local band.
Actually insane. Yeah,
yeah, I wish.
They were fucking like, you can totally tell why they broke up, because they were like, we've put our heart and soul on this record and nobody fucking cares. Nobody likes us. Yeah. And then New Noise.
That's kind of what we're all hoping for, though, isn't it? Really, yeah. We're sitting here, fucking broke-ass local musicians, but in fucking 20 years, some boys will be sitting fucking debating how fucking great that record was that we put out. We know it's that good.
Yeah,
I'll still have copies in my flat. Don't worry.
Living the misunderstood dream.
But I think, you know, New Noise was on Kerrang TV and MTV2 a lot in the early 2000s, which has no doubt got a lot to do with how they suddenly started to gain traction. You know, in their downtime now, we can call it our downtime because they came back together. But
I don't want to psychoanalyze, boys, but maybe when we called this Unsung Podcast, we were really referring to ourselves, that we feel we deserve so much better.
Nah.
Aye, 100%.
Grant, it's been lovely having you on the show.
Thanks for having me
again. At least people know you now. You can feel seen. Is that what we said? That do you feel seen?
Yeah,
that was kind of your go-to phrase when we were doing the other intros.
I feel heard and seen.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, we're going to do this again. We'll probably be another couple of co-hosts because I think there's some merit in it, and we get to talk about records that we otherwise probably wouldn't talk about in depth.
They're probably really good for, you know, our social media, though.
Absolutely.
Let's just go through the top 10 selling albums of all time.
Next week, The Bodyguard official soundtrack.
Before we wrap up, like, share, comment, subscribe, do all of that cool shit.
Yeah, we need some help.
We definitely
do need a wee bit of help, please. So, like, shares, posts, anything that you can. What is it? Private messaging. It's like if you share an episode via, like,
directly to a person that's seen it. Better than Instagram, and all the algorithms see that as being better.
Yeah.
But also share it to your feeds, because we want more people to see it as well. Yeah. So please do that.
Aye. Okay. Thanks a lot, folks. Grant, see you pretty soon.
Nice one. Cheers, guys.